coming up on Golf Today. Tiger was the headliner at TGL last night. Red shirt, mic'd up, hanging with kids and company. What worked and what fell short? Our roundtable will debate. And Rory is looking for 3 straight wins in Dubai, but what else does he seek? A 5th major, unity in the game. Rory tells all. Plus, we speak to the fan who took home $100,000 after making a hole in one over Bryson's house. What was the best part of his day with DeChambeau? We're coming up aces on Golf Today. That's awesome.
Golf Today.
And live golf coming your way on Golf Channel at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. We're leading you into the final round of the Bahamas Golf Classic at Atlantis Paradise Island. Exciting 2025 season in store for the Korn Ferry Tour. Welcome. This is Golf Today. Damon Hack alongside Eamon Lynch, Golf Week Magazine. Yesterday, Tiger Woods made his long-awaited debut on TGL. Did you watch and enjoy?
I did. It was interesting to see, you know, TGL rolls out its biggest gun and he fires blanks. I mean, last night was not a good night for TGL. And I've been an advocate for this product. I hope it works still at this point, but they had, you know, glitchy technology, another blowout, uncompetitive match, painfully bad interviews. They simply don't know if they're a golf product or an entertainment product. And they're caught somewhere in between and not being particularly good at either one right now.
Well, I don't think Tiger's missed a green with a wedge since 1996. So there may have been some technological flaws that need to be ironed out. But isn't it additive just to have Tiger Woods in a red shirt with golf clubs in his hands?
It's additive in the sense, at least we're getting to see Tiger play. And there's entertainment value to it to an extent. I just think it's in kind of a no man's land right now. There are still teething problems that have not been fixed. And the initial curiosity has worn off now. So now it's going to start to be judged on the product because you've got past the curiosity, you've got past Tiger rolling out, you've got another week to go before you get Rory 2 weeks from now. I think next week's going to be a really big week for
TGL. It's time to produce, says Eamon Lynch.
And to deliver. Well, with reaction to last night's events, we welcome in two writers who speak for an entire generation. Our Golf Channel Roundtable, Ryan Lavner, Golf Channel Senior Writer, and Golf Digest's Joel Beale. Ryan, I want to start with you. We've talked a lot over the last week or two about TGL. We've now finally seen Tiger make his debut. Did anything change in your view of this product last night, for better or worse?
Yeah, I think so, Eamon. I think it's fair to say that this was clearly not as strong as the debut match was just a week earlier. The competition somehow was even more of a blowout. It went 20 minutes long. You know, in person last week at the SoFi Center, I felt like the second hour dragged, and I was surprised to see that on TV watching it last night, it felt that exact same way. I think the main differentiator between weeks one and weeks two was that we saw some really poor shots on Tuesday night, to the point that you wondered whether the simulator was actually working properly. And that's a foundational issue for TGL, if guys can't dial in their distances from 150 or they don't trust it, that's a really big problem if you're asking guys potentially to be putting real life cash on the outcome and particular shots. And so you see Tiger missing greens with wedges. You see guys saying they flushed it and it's coming up short in the bunkers. You see guys not even sniffing the hole on 10 footers. Like, I still think TGL had its moments. I still think it's cool second screen fodder, and I obviously would agree with most people that if this is a close match, we would probably be having entirely different perspective on what this looks like and what it can be. But I really do think that there's work to do in order to make this a smashing success.
Joel, you were prolific on X last night. You called this a step back, stilted conversation, choppy production, and you also mentioned that you want to see some new blood, maybe some different voices that maybe the players we're seeing right now just don't have that comedic gene, as it were. What would you like to see different?
Yeah, I think there actually could be a long-term audience for this product. It's just, and you know, Eamon just touched on it. Right now, the product doesn't know what it is, which is a little concerning given the operation was gifted an extra year to kind of work out the kinks. And this still just comes off as a half-baked idea at the moment. It's pitched as entertainment, but it's treating itself too hard to be an actual competition. And treating this like a regular sport is just missing the point. You have to really lean into the goofiness, because these guys are competitors at their heart, and that's going to come through no matter how trivial the game is. And I think a lot of that actually falls on the production side. We as you mentioned, we need someone to be kind of funny and loose behind the mic to actually provide golf commentary when need be. At the moment, the crew that has been working, it's a non-golf crew that hasn't really livened things up. It needs to be shorter. I think two hours plus is at least an hour too long. The current format, it gets very repetitive. I feels like it'd be a lot better as a non-live sport, allowing production to kind of cut and clean up the presentation. I mean, TGL would probably counter that. Hey, that probably knocks out the betting and gambling aspect. But I mean, if you're gambling on guys hitting golf balls into computer screens on a simulator that's not exactly working, like, my man, go get some help. I will say though, like, there has been a lot of criticism, at least last night compared to the debut. We always rip golf for not being innovative. So kudos for at least trying something here. And I do think there could be something here for a sect of golfers. But just right now, this comes across as an entity that is just trying to pad the bank accounts of the golfers and the brain trust behind it. And I think fans can see right through it.
Ryan, I want to move on to real golf right now. Rory McIlroy met with the media in Dubai today, and he was asked to respond to John Rahm's comments yesterday when Rahm said we are in the golden age of golf right now. And Rory's response was that John was looking at it through rose-tinted glasses, that he's not really acknowledging how fractured and disjointed the game is. Which side of that argument are you coming down on? Are you closer to the Rahm end of things or the Rory end of things?
I think Rory, as we sit here in January 2025, is more spot on with his analysis. I mean, John Rahm himself, a day earlier, acknowledged that, you know, a year and a half removed from the framework agreement, he is surprised that things have not progressed in a manner that I think most reasonable people would have expected. I do think, you know, potentially when you get 2 or 3 years down the line, if LIV players can and are reintegrated into the PGA Tour, and it is sort of more of a global enterprise, and you do have different formats, and you can mix up what has been sort of a stale PGA Tour product, then yeah, I think you could get to a place that is operating, as John Rahm said, at a higher level. But right now, as we sit here in January 2025, I mean, the game's as fractured as it possibly could be. You look at what the schedule for LIV is going to be, what the schedule for the PGA Tour looks like for 2025. You're going to have golf fans' attentions divided even more than they were in the previous couple of years, and that's no good for anybody.
Joel, what are you hearing from colleagues or maybe even friends that are watching professional golf or not watching professional golf? January is supposed to be a month of optimism and excitement, welcoming the game back. Are people still frustrated at the fractures atop the game, or are they, you know, looking forward to the new year, somewhat excited about TGL? I mean, January is supposed to be all good. We're not supposed to be whining until later in the summer.
Yeah, I think there's definitely, I feel like it's more apathetic than it's ever been. At this point, it's definitely turned people off. I think there was some enthusiasm off TGL, but at this moment, yeah, I think a lot of fans are just waiting for this to get over. I think they're... The more I kind of hear about it, it's just, I think people from outside the golf ecosystem, they look at this pursuit for golf to try to be something it's not. It's just very myopic. It sort of reminds me of a fast food chain trying to diversify its menu. Like, hey, we're serving breakfast now. You know, we have vegan options. It's like, I don't know, Burger King. I don't know if you've perfected the burger yet. Maybe focus on that. I'm sorry if Burger King's a golf channel sponsor, but golf was just blessed with this influx of participation over the past 5 years. And at the top level, things have never been worse. So to me, these TGL things, all these other new things, like, it doesn't matter how much you branch out, the core is rotten, all this is for naught.
On that subject of how it's kind of in conflict right now, Joel, there are reports that LIV is close to a deal with Fox Sports to broadcast its events in the United States. Half of the schedule is around the world, but their last three events on the LIV schedule are going week to week to week against the three FedEx Cup playoff events, do you think that's some kind of genius move to go up against three of the strongest fields of the year on the PGA Tour to make a statement? Or is that the last petty act of Greg Norman before he left?
I don't know if anything associated with LIV can be classified as genius. It also doesn't really matter. I mean, there's no one's watching this, so it doesn't matter when they go up against anything. You know, the Fox Sports play seems more to be in correlation with what Fox Sports wants out of the World Cup in 2034, right? Which is visiting Saudi Arabia, the backers of LIV. So, yeah, I've seen wonders of why exactly they would go against the FedEx Cup. But at the same time, it's not like the FedEx Cup has been drawing that big of numbers the past couple of years either. So it just goes back to what we just discussed. This is ultimately, this hurts not LIV or the PGA Tour. It hurts the fan because this is just becoming a watered-down product that's already watered down in itself. So, these reports about Fox Sports, I guess that's better than the CW, although I think apparently CW has a wider audience, so I'm not sure. Obviously, Fox Sports is in the industry, but it's not in the golf industry, so I'm not sure how this helps diversify what LIV's trying to build in their audience.
The uncertainty of 2024 has followed us into 2025. Lav, Joel, thank you for your time this morning.
Thanks, guys.
Well, as we mentioned, while you were sleeping, Rory McIlroy met the media in Dubai, had some choice comments on Jon Rahm and on a potential move to LIV by his own protege. More on that coming up.
We're back on Golf Today. It's time for the Rolex Series report. This week, DP World Tour is at Emirates Golf Club for the first Rolex Series event of 2025, the Hero Dubai Desert Classic. Rolex Series continues in July with the Genesis Scottish Open, heads to Wentworth Club in September for the BMW PGA Championship, Yas Links in November for the Abu Dhabi Championship, and the Rolex Series concludes November 13th through the 16th with the DP World Tour Championship.
Rory McIlroy has won here in Dubai four times, including each of the last 2 years. 2023 wasn't short of drama. The week began with Patrick Reed flipping a tee at him. It ended with Rory McIlroy clipping him by a single stroke with a final round of 68. And then last year, he entered the final round two shots behind Cameron Young, but by the final hole, he just needed two putts from short range to capture his fourth Hero Dubai Desert Classic title, his 17th DP World Tour win. He met with the media and talked about his schedule for 2025.
Played 27 events last year, and you spoke about trying to cut that down for this year. I wondered, have you sort of worked out in your head what that might look like, and will that be as many tour events over here on this tour as well?
I think I'll play like 12 total for the year. I'll probably play, including the Ryder Cup, something like 22.
Okay.
I'd say my DP World Tour schedule will be pretty similar to what it was last year. Obviously, we don't have the extra event here in Dubai this year. But you would, I'd imagine that my schedule sort of after the summer will look very, very much the same. So, if anything, I'll play a similar schedule here and just, shave off some events over in the States.
Jon Rahm was in here yesterday and he said, we're in a golden era for golf with endless possibilities. I just wondered if what you take on that characterization, is it something you'd agree with or where would you sit? It's
very rose-tinted glasses, if you ask me. I think it's a... I think what I would say is with everything that's happened in the game over the past 2 or 3 years, I think what I maybe could envision is the domination of the American side of things might come back a little bit in terms of the not that the game's never been global, but sort of trying to build on the opportunities globally. So I think we are in a good position to try to grow that part of it. And there's amazing players, right? There's amazing players that play in all different tours and parts of the world and everything. Which is great, but at the same time, it's become too fractured and too disjointed. So I would share his optimism if the game wasn't as disjointed and as fractured as it was. And maybe we'll get to that point sometime in the near future. And if we do, then I would share that optimism.
Rory, if you go back 18 months or so, your head was probably all over the place with everything was going on in the golf world and the role you took on. How clear is that head now, and how important is that for you going into this year?
Yeah, it's really nice to just focus on the golf. I'm not that like I feel like what everything that's happened over the last few years is, you know, yeah, I've learned from it and I've been through it, and it's been a really good experience in some ways. But yeah, I think it's time now. You know, I'm still youngish. I feel young, but you know, I'm at a point in my career where I really just have to look after myself and really care about myself and think about myself, and that's what I'm doing going forward. And it's nice to knuckle down and feel like my game's in good shape. And you know, I've been close to doing some really good things in the game of golf over the last few years. I have done some really good things, but you know, it's, you know, I understand that the window is, you know, very slowly closing, and I want to make sure I do everything I can to have the best career I possibly can.
Make you feel old when Rory McIlroy is talking about the window closing?
Young-ish. I'll tell you what, we were just talking to Joel and Ryan Lavner about January and the optimism. Every year this time of year feels like it has the potential to be a Rory year, doesn't it? You look at the last 10-plus years, he's had 21 top 10s in major championships since he won the last one. He's had four runner-up finishes, Eamon, in majors since that last title in 2014. He says his head is clear, the game is there. I like the lineup of venues, even if you don't, for him. Augusta, Quail Hollow, Oakmont, Port Rush. There was pressure last time. I think there's knowledge this time and maybe a little less of a cluttered head to be able to get something done. At some point, he's going to hit the right shot and someone else is going to miss that shot, and maybe 2025 will be the year.
And it's not as though he's out there in the doldrums, because Rory McIlroy's made the point himself that he argued that the only two guys who had better years than him last year were Scottie Scheffler and Xander Schauffele, who both had career years. It's kind of a valid argument to make, but it feels as though every year we hear Rory say that he's done with the outside the rope stuff, that he's not getting involved in that. It's not true. He's not capable of staying out of it. And he keeps getting pulled into it as well, because
curious mind?
Yes, but he's also a useful advocate for anyone who wants to make an argument or push an agenda out there, because he is curious. He does want to see the golf game get reunited and driven to a new place that is potentially more global. And he has advocates even inside the PGA Tour for that as well, this idea of making a schedule once the FedEx Cup schedule concludes, that the game could actually drift more towards Europe and Australasia and South Africa. But there are also players on the PGA Tour who have no interest in getting passport stamps and aren't really particularly keen on seeing it go down that road. Rory's an influential voice and an advocate for that, so he's always going to find himself getting sucked back into these kind of arguments. And it would be nice if he was focused entirely on what's inside the ropes. I think he's focused sufficiently on that, but he's never going to be focused exclusively on it. He's too important a voice in the game to be allowed to drift off like that, because frankly, the other person in the game who has a big voice is Tiger Woods, and Tiger doesn't use that voice, at least not in public.
Do you think he's right that this game is going to be drifting more toward an international schedule, whatever it ultimately looks like, if it's 2026 or 2027? I mean, Rory's talked about South African Open being one of the big events, you know, an Irish Open, a Scottish Open, making the game even more global than it is for someone who's lived, you know, in Dubai, lived in Europe, lived in the United States, who has that knowledge about life abroad.
There's a romanticism that's attached to this global idea about the Australian Open, that it used to be one of the great tournaments in golf, and the South African Open the same way. Those events haven't had domestic corporate support to keep them at the level they've had. So the question becomes, who's going to underwrite those events to make them global? I do think we are going to see the game take on a more global look with the support and buy-in of the PGA Tour after the FedEx Cup season concludes in August. Then I think from then to the end of the year, you're going to see the bigger events on the DP World Tour probably get a clear run. The question is how many top PGA Tour players would buy into that and say, yes, I'm willing to go play Kingston Heath in Australia, or I'm willing to go play Fancourt in South Africa or somewhere like that, because a lot of those guys aren't. I do think that's ultimately going to be what the new landscape looks like to some degree. That's certainly what Rory McIlroy has been advocating for.
Rory, immensely popular, knowledgeable. He's also been a mentor to a number of players to come behind him. And of late, reports have been swirling about Rory's longtime friend Tom McKibben from Hollywood Golf Club in Northern Ireland, just like Rory, regarding McKibben's rumored consideration to join LIV Golf. Here was Rory's advice to his young friend earlier today.
Look, I said to him, if I were in your shoes, I would make a different choice than the one you're thinking of making. I think, you know, working so hard to get your tour card in the States, that's something that he really did to achieve that goal last year, you know, was a big achievement. And I just, you know, I think what he potentially is sacrificing and giving up with access to majors, potential Ryder Cup spot, depending on, you know, how he would play, it wouldn't have been, or, you know, depending, look, I don't think anything's official yet, but it you know, if I were in his position and I had his potential, which I think I have been in it before, I wouldn't make that decision. But I'm not him. I'm not in his shoes. You know, he's a grown man at this point and can make his own decisions. All I can do is try to give him my perspective. And yeah, look, it would be, you know, personally for me, it would be a little disappointing if it were to happen. But again, it's not like I made it perfectly clear. I am not going to stand in your way to make a decision that you feel like you need to make for yourself. But at the same time, I just feel like he's giving up a lot to not really benefit that much, you know?
Wonder whose voice will carry more weight, Rory's or maybe Eugenio Chikara, who's regretting his time, at least saying, hey, I got a lot of money, but I'm basically invisible compared to Ludvig Åberg. What do you think of what Rory is telling young Tom, who's 22 as of last month?
Rory has been a mentor to Tom McKibben since Tom was a child, basically 10 or 11 years old. His voice does carry a lot of weight, but there are also other people, I'm guessing, in Tom McKibben's circle of friends and advisors and family whose voice carries weight as well. The reality is this is only a money decision. It's where do you wish to make money or how do you wish to make it? Do you wish to make it guaranteed on LIV? Or now that you've earned the right to compete against the best on the toughest tour, do you wish to earn it that way? And the reality is LIV is not throwing around the money that it was throwing around in 2022 or 2023 when it was particularly desperate to get guys. And they're not going to throw a gratuitous amount of money at Tom McKibben relative to what good performance could actually make Tom McKibben
right
on the PGA Tour. So it's a matter of, really, do you want to go down easy street thinking that in a couple of years that the status that you've earned or that the game that you have and have developed will be there and your access to majors, to potential Ryder Cups, to the PGA Tour will be returned? That's a big gamble to make because that's the gamble Eugenio Chikara made. And right now, a couple of years later, after joining LIV, he's playing the Asian Tour because he doesn't have status anywhere else. So it is a big gamble that Tom McKibben would be making, especially when he has worked to the extent that he had to get that very last spot
yeah.
on the DP World Tour last year to earn his card here. Matthew Pavon did that last year. He's already a winner on the PGA Tour.
He's surprised he's even considering it, knowing that he kind of grew up in the shadow of Rory, but as a mentor in a positive way. I mean, I met Tom. He came over to the old Orlando Golf Channel studios when he was a teenager.
I'm not surprised that anyone who's 22 years old earlier in their career, and if they're offered, you know, $5 or $6 or $7 million of guaranteed money for a couple of years, of course they're going to consider it. In his case, he's got to consider what is a longer term career trajectory
right.
that he wants to be on, because everyone who's gone to LIV has headed into a cul-de-sac.
The story will continue to follow. Speaking of money, stay with us, because if $100,000 was on the line and all you had to do was make a hole-in-one over Bryson DeChambeau's house, could you pull it off? Well, the man who did just that joins us next. Jimmy Elliott joins us on this Wednesday. Congratulations. Before we get to the shot, which was awesome, I mean, Bryson is prolific on social media, as you know. How did this competition even come about? How did you end up at his house?
Yeah, it was wild. He had posted something on Instagram saying that they were going to be filming a video in the DFW area. I live in Fort Worth, and so I just applied for it. Turns out, from my understanding, they had about 6,000 to 7,000 entries. And then they ended up on me for the final challenge. I had no idea what I was doing. They basically just said, hey, you're going to be a part of a video to win some prizes. And that's all I knew going into the day.
I'm curious. The swing looks good, Jimmy. I'm curious what the skill level is, because most of us would have looked at those floor-to-ceiling windows and thought about how much it would cost to replace them if we knifed one into his living room. What is your actual handicap?
My current handicap is a 0.0.
That's pretty good.
0.0. Did you catch the shot exactly as you liked? Did you think it was going to be close?
It felt good. I walk into every shot, and so the two things I was thinking about was don't hit the window, and then if you're going to be a bear, be a grizzly, and let's go make it. So I felt pretty confident, but to make it that early was, I think, a shock to us all.
Bryson did mention that you had 7 hours to complete the challenge. It looked as though you only needed a couple of minutes. How many balls did you go there expecting that you were going to hit?
I was confident I could make it. I think I said it in the video, I thought it was going to take me about 4 or 5 hours to make the shot. Enough repetition, I feel decent with once I get it down, I could do it again. But five shots is still mind-boggling to me.
So what do you do with the rest of your time? I mean, he's given you 7 hours. You make it on the fifth swing, and now you guys are looking at each other like, now what do you do?
Exactly. He Bryson was great. We looked at each other and said, all right, what do we do with the rest of the day? And he was so gracious. You know, it's New Year's Eve. There's a random guy at his house, and he made me feel like $1 million the entire day. We threw the Frisbee. We played some horse. We went to lunch. He showed me his house. I got to see the U.S. Open trophy. Got to see the letter from Augusta inviting him to the Masters. So as a golf junkie, it was just I was giddy the entire time. But he, like I said, he made me feel like $1 million for the entire time I was there. I think I stayed until 3, just hanging out with him and his film crew. And I can't say enough nice things about them.
Other golf junkies want to know, what club were you hitting and how long was the distance that you had to travel over the house?
Yeah. So he told me, Bryson told me it was a 98-yard shot and plays down 3. So a 95-yard shot. I started with a 54-degree. I thought it was cold, though I thought felt like the wind was into us. I didn't want to swing hard right off the bat. My first goal was just get it over the house, avoid the windows. And then after a couple shots, I dropped it down to a 58-degree, and that turned out to be the right club.
That's a great picture with you and Bryson. If we can put it up again, it looked like there was like a grand piano behind you. Did Bryson play a couple songs for you, or did you sit down and play like New York, New York, maybe in advance of the Ryder Cup? That's a beautiful piano.
No, I am not musically talented, but one of his film crew guys, Adam, he sat down and played a few songs for us, played a little guitar, and he was phenomenal. It was so fun. That was part of the remaining 5 hours, just getting to hang around his house and just get to hang out with the guys.
What do you intend to spend the $100,000 on, Jimmy? Because I know it's been an up and down few years for you and your family.
Yeah, no, great question. We're definitely going to give some of the money away to some charities that just mean a lot to us, that are near and dear to our heart. At the same time, we're gonna spend a little now on a few things around our house, and then we're also going to save some for our family's future. You know, I have 3 kids, and kids are expensive, and college is not looming, but that price tag is going to come up soon. So. Saving for our future, spending a little bit now, and definitely giving some away.
How are your kids doing? I know you face some challenges with them from a health standpoint. How's your family's health?
Family's health is great. Our oldest, our 7-year-old Beckett, has a rare genetic abnormality called Emanuel syndrome. When he was first born, they told us that there were only 500 known cases in the world. So the range of outcomes is, you know, it's kind of wide. And in a unique way, guys, I look up to that kid. He is the most resilient, fun-loving, warm kid you'll ever meet. And some of my other kids, but being behind the eight ball a little bit with him, he's making tremendous strides. He's learning to walk. He's learning how to talk. And it's just been neat over the past 7 years to see the progress that he's made. You know, in the first year of life, if I'm being completely honest, we didn't know if he would make it. And then getting to the point now where he's at, I can't help but just smile thinking about it.
You also suffered from testicular cancer earlier in your life as well. Days like this must make days like that. Obviously, they're on a very different scale of importance in life, but it must be nice to actually have a day like this to kind of put things like that a little bit farther behind you.
You nailed it. You know, you never expect things like this to happen to you. And so just being able to take advantage of that opportunity and regardless of making the shot, which was awesome, just getting to spend a day with Bryson, you know, the reigning US Open champ, it was just so neat. And to see where, you know, we were 5 years ago going through chemo and having to go down to MD Anderson and do all those treatments, to where we are today and being able to be on Golf Channel with y'all and just talk about this incredible day. It puts things in perspective a little bit, but it was just a phenomenal day.
Jimmy, life is such an interesting journey. Even Bryson DeChambeau would tell you that he's evolved, maybe from being a lightning rod early in his career to really being beloved, especially on social media. We saw the love at Pioneers number 2 that he received. Why do you think he connects so well with fans in this latest incarnation of Bryson?
Yeah, he's just being who he is, right? And I think he's finally able to have a platform where he can just be himself. And I think that's shining through in all these YouTube videos. You see those breaking 50s, trying to break the course records at the public courses, all his different iterations of his YouTube videos. He's just able to be himself. It was super neat. At lunch, we were talking about it. And just hearing his heart behind giving back to a game that has given him so much throughout his entire life was just really cool to hear. And so it's a genuine response to just wanting to give back to the game of golf. And I think people can see, just see the honesty in it. And it's been really neat. Like you said, a lightning rod, even portrayed as maybe a villain a few years back to being what, you know, labeled as the people's champ. And you could, even in the seven hours that I was there, you could tell he was genuinely more excited than I was that I made the shot. And so just being able to witness that firsthand, he has a fan for life in me.
Jimmy, it's quite a story. It's quite a shot. Thanks for explaining it all to us on this Wednesday. Enjoy it. And best of luck to you and your family as well going forward.
Thank you, fellas. I appreciate y'all having me on.
There he is, Jimmy Elliott. Can we take one more look, by the way, at this epic shot, this epic reaction? This is the new, you know, odd couple in golf, Bryson and Jimmy. Peanut butter and jelly, Sonny and Cher, the captain and Tennille, making some social media matches.
We're back on Golf Today. Justin Thomas, still looking for his first PGA Tour victory since the PGA Championship back in 2022. His 2024 season included 6 top 10s, but 4 missed cuts out of 20 events, and he also missed out on being part of Jim Furyk's President's Cup team in the fall. And as he does each year, JT took to social media to recap the goals he set for himself in 24, saying, "Here is my yearly humble pie from some of my goals from the season. A lot of good, plenty of room for improvement, but tons of excitement for the next season." Before the start of the year at the Century, Justin Thomas met with the media and discussed the goals for 2025.
Are your expectations any different than they were in pick a year? I'm not saying you're going to do it, but...
They aren't, to be honest. Like, I still expect the same things. I understand it's not realistic in the percentages, and then the likeliness of it is probably not, but I still fully believe that I can have a year like Scotty just had. I mean, there's no reason. I think I would be doing myself a disservice if I didn't think I could at least do that. I mean, I have a lot of faith and capability in my game, and I feel like I'm working on the right things, but it doesn't just happen because you think you can and because you think you deserve it. You have to work harder than everybody else, and you have to do the right things. And so I do think that I'm capable of as much as I am the other years. But that doesn't necessarily, like you said, that doesn't mean that it will or won't happen today.
Justin Thomas would go on to finish the century, tied for 26th. This week, he makes his second start of the season at the American Express. That's where we find our own Rex Hager joining us now from La Quinta. Rex, what are your expectations for the two-time PGA champ in 2025?
Damon, I want to see him play quote-unquote pissed off. That's what he told reporters a few weeks ago, and Maui was his goal coming in to this season. Now, full disclosure, he was talking about not making last year's President's Cup team and how that was going to be motivation for him, but you also look at the way he finished off last season. He clearly felt like he turned a corner. Go and look what he did in the Bahamas at Tiger's event. In that field, he hit the ball better than anyone else. That's a field that included Scottie Scheffler, so you know you're doing something well on that front. Before that, he finished runner-up at the Zozo. He's heading in the right direction. But when, if you broke down what he thumbed into that phone at the beginning of the year for his goals, clearly the Ryder Cup is going to be on top of that list. Making that team, playing at Bethpage Black, how involved he was in the process to make Keegan Bradley the captain, that's going to be on top of his list. Going back to Quail Hollow for the PGA Championship, that 2017 version of JT was probably the best version of JT. So that's going to give him some motivation. But when it comes to expectations and finally breaking through and getting that next victory on the PGA Tour, the one thing that he's going to have to focus on is his putting. A lot like his full swing, he is not working with a putting coach. And he's talked about the idea that he still feels like he's a good putter. He just needs the confidence. And as we all know, this event is nothing more than a putting contest. This would be a good week to get started.
Rex Hager at the driving range at the American Express. We appreciate his report on Justin Thomas, who I believe is on the driving range on this Wednesday. And you heard Rex talk about his putting, 174th in strokes gained putting in 2024. I mean, it had to be soul-crushing for JT not to be a part of that President's Cup team, considering his 17-7-4 record across the Ryder Cup and President's Cup, a guy considered match play royalty as far as the United States is concerned.
But he also knows the rules of the game when it comes to team competition, which is, what have you done for me lately? And the answer really hasn't been very much. And when you look at his record in 2024, it's not so much just missing a President's Cup team. It's the fact that in the events that really define legacies, in which you're up against the best players every time, the major championships, he really underperformed. He actually played pretty well in the one that where he was under most pressure, probably at his hometown, Louisville, Kentucky. He finished tied eighth in the PGA Championship, but he missed the cut in spectacular fashion at the Masters. He missed the cut at the United States Open at Pinehurst, then he finished tied 31st in the Open at Royal Troon. And those are events where JT's actually going to expect to perform. And it comes down to the same things with him. If you look at his numbers over the last few years in two particular areas, which is his strokes gained putting, which you mentioned, and his driving accuracy off the tee. And, you know, he's cracked the top 150 once in the last 5 years in driving accuracy, and that was 144th. And only once has he been better than 104th in strokes gained putting. And those are two crucial keys to try to even out for him if he wants to play at the level that he did play at in several years.
And it's interesting to hear Rex say that he wants to see Justin Thomas play the, quote, pissed off golf that he needs to. And there's reasons for him to be upset. This was, however brief it was, a former world number one. Justin Thomas has 15 PGA Tour victories on the CV. This is someone who has extremely high expectations. And I think the fact that, listen, it was a surprise to a lot of people that Zach Johnson took him for the Ryder Cup team, considering he missed the playoffs. Last year, he makes it all the way to Atlanta. I would say conventional wisdom was that Jim Furyk would absolutely select him for the President's Cup team. I love that he details his goals every season going into the year, and the Ryder Cup, the President's Cup, is always high on the list, bold type, and it had to really hit him where it hurt that he was not at Royal Montreal.
True, he is a world number one and a 15-time tour winner, but he hasn't won but once in the last 4 years, and he's now 21st in the official world golf ranking. But another week, another opportunity for Justin Thomas. As we go to break, a reminder, the coverage of the American Express gets underway tomorrow, 4 p.m. Eastern. If it's a Wednesday, it must mean Victor Hovland has a new swing instructor. The most fascinating mind in the game is talking about the state of his game and the search for something new. We'll hear from him on what's wrong, what's right, and what's next. And Nick Taylor has shown a knack for performing in clutch moments, most recently a Sony Open playoff at the weekend. We're going to meet the man whose job it is to prepare Taylor to do exactly that. And Gary Williams will be here, which means there isn't a newsworthy topic we won't tackle. Golf Today continues right now.
Golf Today.
We're leading you into live golf at the top of the hour here. Final round coverage of Bahamas Golf Classic at Atlantis Paradise Island. That's on the Corn Ferry Tour. Things are tightening up in the island. Welcome back into Golf Today, hour two. Eamon Lynch alongside Damon Hack. And we spent a lot of time talking about the action of the veterans in a couple of deserts here. One in Dubai, one in the California desert. But there's a little next generation incubator going on this week as well.
Yeah, Latin America Amateur Championship. Rich Lerner is the voice of the event. We'll get to him in just a little bit. I love the stories that are told and really kind of learning about some of these players who will end up being maybe one day on the PGA Tour or playing in professional golf. And Rich really kind of digs into the storylines this week.
There is no happier place for Rich Lerner than diving into a place like this, particularly in a place like Buenos Aires. He spent a few years traveling back and forward there. He spent some time with Roberto DiVincenzo as well. One of Rich's sort of great stories involves spending time with that old veteran.
Loves reporting on the history of the game. And yes, indeed, this week is the 10th edition of the Latin America Amateur Championship being played at Pilar Golf Club in Buenos Aires, Argentina. 72-hole stroke play event with a cut for the leading 50 players plus ties after 36 holes. And the champion will receive an invitation into the 2025 Masters Tournament and exemptions into the 2025 Open, the U.S. Open, the 2025 Amateur Championship, and the 2025 U.S. Amateur Championship as well. And a very strong history. Some strong alums have come through the Latin America Amateur Championship with the trophy and no doubt wonderful stories to tell about their experiences as well. With more on this week's event, we send it out to Rich Lerner and a very special guest.
Eamon, Damon, thank you. Pleased to be joined now by Andy North, two-time U.S. Open champion. Andy and I have been to every Latin America Amateur Championship. I'll start with a simple question. What do you love about the Latin Am?
I think it's the opportunities for these kids. I mean, you start looking at, I had a great chance to grow up and got to play in USGA Juniors and the stuff in America that there's no such thing down here for so many years. And now to have an event that the kids can work their entire year for to get to, and because of this event, there's been more activity in the junior golf range and amateur golf range throughout these countries. There's a lot of championships now the players can play in, but this is the one that they all look at.
Where have you seen improvement in the 10 years?
Pretty much every aspect of the game. If you look at the quality of the golf courses, the agronomy of the golf courses have changed dramatically. The USGA has been down here working with the superintendents hand in hand, and we've seen this golf course 10 years ago to today, totally different. It's an amazing. Then you look at the quality of the players. The quality of golf around South America, Central America has changed and evolved so dramatically. We had players that shot in the hundreds in this event the first year. Mm. Now the scoring is amazing. You look down the range, see really good quality golf swings, and the results are there. You look at the players who've come out of here. We've got some guys on tour doing really well.
Significant investment made by the founding partners, the Masters Tournament, the RNA, and the USGA. All expenses paid for all 108 players. Why is it important to continue to do this?
Well, I think we want to grow this game in a way that you continue excellence in the game and great players. And you don't do that just by mistake. You have to have events for these players to play in. And the Pacific Amateur started a few years before this. And then this one, it gives these young men great opportunities to do some things that they never thought or dreamed they were going to be able to do.
I happen to love the level of gratitude. Mm-hmm. That we see. It's great to be around young people striving for excellence, but beyond that, there's a real palpable sense that they're appreciative of what the founding partners have done.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the fact that they fly the kids here, they put them up in really nice hotels, they wine and dine them basically the whole week. Some of these kids have come from environments that have been amazing to get here. I mean, the stories that we've put on air of kids starting out, how'd you learn to play golf? I took the round ball out of a deodorant and hit it around on it with a stick for years before I actually got to play golf. So, you know, we don't realize sometimes the environments that the kids have grown up in and where they've been able to get to. It's great.
Been some players who've come out of the Latin America Amateur Championship gone on to have some success in the professional ranks. Who comes to mind?
Well, I mean, obviously, Echeverria, who finished second last week, lost in the playoffs, won a couple times on tour. Joaquin Niemann, Alvarez. I mean, there's been a ton of good young players that have come out because of this. And it gives them something to really work for. I know I've got to practice hard because this event's coming in 3 months. I think that's really important.
I think every player here would love someday to start a PGA Tour season at Kapalua. You were there for the 2025 opener. Been around this game, Andy, a long time. Calling golf and playing it at the highest levels, going back to the days of Nicklaus and Palmer. What's your sense of the modern professional game as we get going here in 2025?
Well, the game itself has changed dramatically because of the equipment. I mean, the distances that these players are hitting the golf ball really has changed how the game is played. You have to use distance as a major strength now. I mean, the game I grew up in, it was about finesse, technique, get the ball in play, get it around. Hitting a 5-iron into a par 4 was normal. You didn't think anything of it. Now, if you're hitting a 5-iron into a par 4, guys are looking like, what are we doing? This hole's 550 yards long. So the game itself has changed somewhat that way, but the skill and the hard work that's put in hasn't. And I think that's, we've got a ton of great young players. Every single year we see some new players come on tour, which I think really just strengthens the whole thing.
You have any concerns about the business side? And if so, what might they be?
We could talk about the business side of it for months. I don't like the fact that where we've been the last couple of years, it's you know, we've got some split in the game of golf. But hopefully that's all going to get worked out. I think so often the money drives these sports, which I don't particularly like. Obviously, it's important. The guys are making great livings. That's important for the players. But I think sometimes we get carried away and we lose sight of what it really is about.
It's a 25-year anniversary of what most believe is the greatest single season of all time, Tiger Woods in 2000. How much of Tiger's 2000 campaign did you cover?
We were there for an awful lot of it, and it was really a lot of fun. We had these discussions at Kapalua a couple of weeks ago that I was there in that playoff with Ernie and Tiger, and that just started the 2020 season, which was amazing. You had Tiger was the best player in the world, and there were three or four guys that were in that next group, and Ernie was one of them. And the two guys playing at their best, hitting, you know, shots into the 18th hole with three woods and two irons, making eagles to get to playoffs, that kind of stuff was amazing. But the quality of golf Tiger played that year was so much fun to be around, so much fun to watch. I had the opportunity to walk down the last fairway with him, a few of those wins. It was just overwhelming, and it's probably the greatest year of golf, throwing out the Nelson year during the war.
What was the bet you had with Mike Tirico?
Yeah. Mike and I were working together through most things. There was an 11 major stretch where I took Tiger and he had the field. I actually won 7 out of the 11. So thank you, Mike, for some nice dinners.
What separated Tiger?
Well, I think he was what made him the best in that year is that he had a great combination of old school, understanding how to attack the golf course, understanding playing shots, hitting the kind of shots you want to play, and combining that new era of distance strength, overpowering the golf course. And he did that better than anybody. When he first came out, he dominated lengthwise, just like Nicklaus did when Jack came out in the early 60s. Mm.
I know you're great friends with Jack. You competed against the Golden Bear. What more did Tiger and Jack have in common, and maybe where were they different?
I think if you go back and look at their numbers, it's amazing how similar their careers were. The amount of tournaments they won, how they won. When they got to the top of the leaderboard, no one caught them. They forced other players to do things those players weren't capable of doing. And that's why they just coasted in. I was lucky enough to play with Jack when he won the Players 1 year. And looking at him play, he didn't play very well that day. It was the Sunday, the wind was blowing, he just kind of got it around and ended up winning. You don't have to be perfect. I think guys forget that, but you have to understand how to attack the golf course, put yourself in position to be there at the end.
Scottie Scheffler is the current world number one. Do you think he's capable of, say, winning 35, 40 times in 6-7 majors? Why or why not?
Oh, absolutely. I think Scottie is that guy. The reason he's got that chance, he's such a good ball striker. He understands how to play the golf courses. He understands when to lay up, when you need to lay up. It's not just driver every single hole. He understands to play away from pins when you have to. And, you know, we've seen him over the last couple of years putt well, but not super great. And if he ever gets into that super great range, putting, making more, he's going to win 8-10 times a year.
How many years you've been holding the microphone calling golf now?
It He's in the 30s. I never thought we'd get through one. So
what a heck of a run. I think he's one of the more underappreciated announcers in our game. Steady voice. Been doing it a long time. I'm looking forward to being in the booth for
what
you and I feel like is one of the great amateur events in the world, and it's just a ton of fun.
This is a great week, and you do an unbelievable job because you love the story tales of all these guys, which is great. You get to do the stories. I get to do golf, and we see out of each other's way. It's perfect.
It's great. Eamon, Damon, back to you.
As Rich mentioned, all year long, we are celebrating Tiger's historic 2000 season. Been a lot of talk on the official world golf rankings of late, but how about this? If you look back to the week in 2000, this week, Tiger, number one on the official world golf ranking, leads second-ranked David Duval by 7.8 average points. That differential between number one and number two is about the same as the difference between the second-ranked Duval and the 20th-ranked Fred Couples. By the way, by May of 2001, after he completed the Tiger Slam, Tiger had built a 19.40 lead in the official world golf ranking. Eamon, he was playing chess while everybody else was playing checkers.
Wasn't even close. Well, our pal Gary Williams has been kicking off the morning schedule here on Golf Channel with some great guests on his Five Clubs podcast show. Gary's with us next, which means Damon is at risk of oxygen deprivation when Gary and I start gas bagging. Stay with us to see if he makes it.
Back on Golf Today. Be sure to tune in this coming Monday for a full morning lineup on Golf Channel, Five Clubs podcast with Gary Williams at 8 a.m. Eastern, then 9 a.m. Fairways of Life with Matt Adams, 10 a.m. Golf Channel podcast with Rex and Lav. And speaking of Gary, a good lineup next week. Matt Adams will join Gary from the PGA Show in Orlando, Florida, 10 miles of Show Isles, one of our favorite weeks of the year, plus Mark Lev, president and CEO of Boston Common Golf, and the Golden Bear himself, Jack Nicklaus, joins on his birthday. Great to have our friend Gary with us on this Wednesday. Listen, we had some great fun back in the day in the simulator in Orlando. What are you doing in the simulator on this Wednesday?
Actually, a golf course that Eamon knows quite well. Not the fairway behind me. That's Nova Scotia. Do you see areas, again, probably not on this screen, that you're familiar with?
I used to have a course record up there, Gary, until Ben Crenshaw snatched it away from me by two strokes, literally 15 minutes after I'd had it.
You were the first one to play the golf course,
that
I assume?
Is correct. I was the first group out, and I was the only one to file a score. Well, thanks. I thought Chambly was supposed to be the pint-sized provocateur around here. We're not auditioning for another one, Williams.
At least it was a World Golf Hall of Fame member that took it from you. And speaking of simulators, G-Dub, what did you think of TGL Night 2, Tiger Woods making his debut?
Couple things. Look, I thought that they made the right choice by not leading with him. The curiosity was there for them to have a good opening night in terms of attracting an audience. And then you roll him out and bring him out to, you know, a smoke machine and Eye of the Tiger. I think a couple things. I think the technology is off the charts great. I do think it helps if the competition is more competitive than they've had over the first 2 weeks. And then, look, I think anything needs a little time to build whatever traction it's going to have. I think that they need an analyst. They have really good broadcasters on there. I think they need somebody beyond feeling the obligation to have the players kind of drive the conversation. Time will tell. But they have the investment of the most important person still in this game, and that is Tiger. So him hitting golf shots into a simulator on a Tuesday night as a build to a Duke basketball game, why not?
There is an assumption, Gary, that things like TGL is where Tiger is now most relevant, except perhaps in the boardroom. And we've been around you long enough to know that you kind of go between being this kind of rosy-eyed old romantic and then a clear-eyed realist. Where do you fall on the Tiger spectrum here? Do you think that that's true, or there is another chapter in Tiger in terms of real competitive golf?
I don't think that chapter is going to be written. And I think Damon and I had this conversation a lot. I don't think people currently, and maybe it's going to take another 10 years, Eamon, for people to understand how extraordinary the build was for him to cross the line again one more time in a major championship in 2019. If you look at what he had done, just look at 2018. in the majors, and specifically the Open Championship, he touches the lead there at Carnoustie. And then at the PGA, he's the last line of defense for Brooks. Then he wins the Tour Championship. And oh, by the way, a couple of weeks before he won the Masters in April of 2019, he clipped Rory in the match play, which I think fortified his mind a little bit more. The only decent result he's had in a major since winning that Masters was the U.S. Open at Pebble Beach just a couple months after that. I don't think that chapter is going to be written again. It doesn't mean that he can't have a day or a couple of days. And certain majors, the Open Championship, the Masters, has always been kind to elders. But those elders did not have a career riddled with significant injury like his. And I'm talking about the likes of Tom Watson. Obviously, Phil won a major after the age of 50. Sam Snead finished in the top five when he was 62 years of age, which is ridiculous. I don't think we're going to have that. And I'm not trying to be a hot take guy. I've felt that since the car accident, that people don't understand the gravity of what his body had already gone through. And then the culmination of it being that right lower leg being in a state of disrepair that's never going to allow him to legitimately contend again.
Well, one of the players who has picked up the mantle from Tiger is Bryson DeChambeau. I know you interviewed Bryson recently. We talked to Jimmy Elliott, who made the hole-in-one over Bryson's house in a social media competition. Lightning Rod, people's champ. Who is Bryson DeChambeau at the age of 31?
Whoever he is, Damon, I think he's more comfortable with that person. I always felt that there was a clumsiness to him, and I think it got a little bit maniacal when he started to embark on the long drive chapter of his career, and he did all the bulking up, and then he had that really silly tiff that went on way too long with Brooks Koepka. I think that he is a much more comfortable person with who that person is, and I do believe he has unequivocally benefited most of anybody in terms of him going to live. And I don't care about the financial component. I'm talking about finding his footing. And I think that there's nobody who has gathered more of an admiring audience with affection, real affection from fans, more than him. And when I had him on the show last week, I said to him just that, guys. I said, I think you benefited to find whatever your equilibrium is more than anybody else. And he agreed.
I've been looking at the show for the last couple of weeks, Gary, an interesting range of guests. You had Andy Roddick yesterday, you've had Jim Nantz, Scott Van Pelt, our buddy Jaime Diaz. All of them have one thing in common. They have never won PGA Tour events. Is that part of the intent here, is that you are taking this big tent approach to this game and the interesting people who exist in it?
Eamon, I hope so. That's the primary ambition. We did have somebody in studio today who did win on the PGA Tour. That was Webb Simpson. But you're right. I'd like to believe that what the show can be, and I mean this modestly, is a community of voices, people who play it at the highest level, but people who cover it at the highest level, but also people who administer the game, people who run companies that drive the industry of golf. Because one of the things that I have bristled at more than anything over the last 3 years is this whole idea that professional golf is the game of golf. No, it isn't. It's the front porch to the game of golf. It's a very attractive front porch. It's a very affluent front porch. It makes the home look more valuable. The home are junior clinics and people who go on trips with their friends to nourish their soul as it relates to being around the game of golf. The game of golf is everything other than the sport of men's professional golf and women's professional golf to a lesser degree. That's a television show. It's a very glossy show. It can be very entertaining at times. And I'd like the show that we're doing to be a community of voices that at times are going to be people who are the best at what they do. But most importantly, it's people who invest in golf in all various ways, from simply watching golf, but also covering golf, writing about golf, and leading companies that make a living out of the industry of golf.
Well, Rory McIlroy has a seat on that front porch. Augusta, Quail, Oakmont, Royal Portrush, G-Dub, is this the year for major number five for Rory?
My gosh. This is Rory's road, is it not, guys? I mean, it is. Portrush, I understand that offers up its own particular challenges, I think, psychologically, emotionally, spiritually for him. Quail, just down the road from where I'm sitting right now, is his happiest haunt in terms of where he won for the first time, where he's had the most success. I think Oakmont, even though he missed the cut in 2016 at the U.S. Open, you guys know, since 2016, he has incrementally grown in terms of his performance at the U.S. Open every year. He was tied for ninth in 2017. He's had back-to-back heartbreaking seconds at Los Angeles Country Club and, of course, last June at Pinehurst. So, yes, this should be the year that not just one, not two, but all four offer him a reasonable chance to break through and cross a Rubicon that historically is the widest one that we've ever seen for a player of his ilk to have four majors. And I've said this several times, on average, the players who have gone from four to five, it's taken all of those players 2.5 years. He's now gone beyond a decade. So he's so far outside of that curve. And don't tell me he doesn't belong in the company of all those players who have five or more, because he does.
Gary, it's always great to spend time with you. We look forward to doing it in the future again. And that hole behind you, you just should aim it down the right side and hit that little snap hook of yours. You'll be fine.
I like shrimp. I can hit a little shrimpy drive as well. I look like a shrimp. I can do all those things.
The great Gary Williams. Well, we saw some amazing short game execution from Nick Taylor in the closing moments of the Sony Open at the weekend. Gareth Rafluski was an interesting watcher too. He's Taylor's short game coach. I'm going to ask him the tricks of the trade coming up next.
Golf Central Update, brought to you by Callaway Golf.
It was an exciting finish to the Sony Open on Sunday. Nick Taylor needed this chip in for eagle to put himself in a playoff position on the 72nd hole. And he drains it. He went on to defeat Nico Echevarria to pick up his fifth career PGA Tour victory. And this guy has a habit of drama in the 72nd hole. Of course, the long putt he made to win the Canadian Open a couple of years ago. He's also won the Waste Management Phoenix Open back in 2024, is now firmly inside the top 30 in the official World Golf ranking. And Nick Taylor's short game coach is Gareth Rafluski, who joins us now from the American Express out in Palm Springs, California. Gareth, what's it like when your guy's heading into a playoff and your nerves are on edge at home watching?
Yeah, thankfully he was doing all the golf that week and not me, you know. So fortunately, we know from Nick's pedigree that he actually loves the big occasion. You know, it's weird because most people would be fretting during that time, but I think that's when he really comes alive. And he's proven time and time again that, you know, that's why all the practice is out here. That's why the Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday is to get that opportunity on Sunday and have a chance to win.
Gareth, I read that when you first started working with Nick, you didn't understand why his putting stats were so poor. What adjustments did you make then?
Well, he was a very conventional putter, normal grip and everything, and his setup just didn't really match the way he was moving the putter. So we'd played around for a couple of months until we found sort of a claw grip that he really liked. And as soon as we did that there, it was game over. He was delivering better loft, his speed control was better. And then we really just worked on helping him see the line a lot better. And, you know, we had that great year a couple of years ago, and it was a breakout year for him. So we've just been sort of rolling along with that.
Gareth, do you work on stuff specifically with Nick that is geared towards those big moments, whether it's on the 18th green at his own National Open, or in particular, the approach to that green during the playoff where he's 58 yards, he's downwind on a firm green, and he hits a perfect short game shot. Are you situational in your teaching for those kind of moments?
100%. You know, like all of these guys out here, they can all hit every shot they absolutely want, but can you hit the shot at the right time? And do you pick the right shot? You know, a lot of times people have the tools, but they just cannot hit the shot they need to, so they're not sure which one. So we do a lot of situational training, especially early on in the week, so they can sort of devise a plan, maybe have one or two different shots that they're going to have around the green that they can trust. And then obviously, if you can trust something, you'll probably execute it a little bit better.
And that was a wonderful shot, another great memory, which has become quite a clutch player on the PGA Tour. I'm curious what the process is of going from conventional to claw. you know, for the folks watching at home, is it a 2-month process, a 2-week process? At what point did Nick feel comfortable maybe going from the practice green to actually putting the claw in competition?
Well, I think he's like every one of us out there. You know, we think it's going to be that miracle drug, and right away we try it. And, you know, he tried it for 2 rounds, I believe. And after 2 rounds, he quit it and played conventional for the next 2 rounds the first time he tried it. And then after that there, he said, you know what, it wasn't good enough to change. You know, I need to stick with it. And I would say within about a month, he was really dialed in, and he really had got his feel and his touch. So anything new is going to take a little bit of time, but you know, if you stick with it, that's where you'll see the benefits. Most amateurs, sadly, will probably change 10 different times in the meantime, so they never really settle on anything, which is difficult.
Gareth, you also teach a lot out on the LPGA Tour. You've worked a lot with Jin Young Ko, the former world number one out there, and you spend a lot of time on that tour. Is there anyone you see out there who, in your mind, is poised for a breakthrough, who probably isn't getting the respect that they deserve in terms of attention right now?
There's a few players that come to mind. One of the one I would think about is Lynn Grant. Lynn's a phenomenal player. I think she's made almost every cut this year. I believe she's only won once on tour. She's 25 years old. She's primed to sort of play well. Everybody out there knows that she's really got the game. I would say that she'd be one to watch for. I would say Patty Tavatanakit too. She sort of had a couple of down years, played obviously good at the start of last year. I would expect her to have another good season this year and maybe even a breakout year for her.
Patty Tavatavikant from UCLA. For the 20 handicapper, the 25 handicapper that you help, especially around the greens, is it the misappropriation of the leading edge and the bounce? What's the biggest issue you see with folks who are sculling and knee dipping, your present company included, Gareth?
I would say that the length of your arms is a big factor. A lot of times what we have a shortening and lengthening of the arms, which makes the radius very difficult to time up. It makes the ground sort of come into focus too often. So I would say making sure you've got the right arm structure as you're swinging around your body will allow you to make contact at the ground at the right time. For that higher handicap, that's generally what we see.
Well, there we go. There's an answer that I've never actually gotten from any other coach. My problem has been my arms are too damn long. Gareth, it's been great chatting with you. Look forward to doing it again.
Thanks a million. Thanks, guys.
And speaking of coaches, hey, looks like Victor Hovland is working with a new swing coach ahead of this week's start in Dubai. Victor's going to get into the weeds. We'll tell you what he said next on Golf Today. Today, let's take a look at what's happening this week as the first Rolex Series event of the year gets underway with the Hero Dubai Desert Classic. It has its 36th edition on the DP World Tour's International Swing, having started back in 89. Strong field we sent out to our friends at Sky Sports, Nick Doherty and Andrew Coltart.
It's going to be a great week in the desert, as it always is, for the Dubai Desert Classic. Andrew Coltart's alongside me. Before we get into the detail, what separates this? We know it's a Rolex Series event, but why do the players love this place?
Yeah, the venue's incredible, Nick. It has grown and blossomed ever since 1989. It's an incredible place to stop off and play. This Majlis course is just a wonderful setup. 3 par 5s on the back nine. There's always an exciting finish around here. The players can go deep. It's just well supported, a great venue to come to, and of course everything is absolutely pristine. We absolutely love it.
Now, we think of guys who've owned venues across the years, like Tiger Woods at Firestone or Bay Hill. Rory, it's this place, the Majlis at the Emirates Golf Club. He has now won here 4 times. He's going for a 5th and 3 in a row. Can he and will he?
He absolutely can. Of course he can. He's done it before. He doesn't have to play a lot. He comes out the blocks pretty quick. Like you said, going for 3 in a row. This 3 of the par 5s around this golf course suit a big high draw. That's perfect for his golf game. He's number one weapon is the driver in his bag, and of course the elevation that he can attack some of these pins from, just dropping some of these lovely long irons out of the sky right on top of the flagsticks. It's well suited for him. He's got great vibes, but not just around this golf course, in this part of the world. He absolutely loves it.
World-class field assembled, mind you, trying to make it hard work for Rory McIlroy. Who are you looking towards to be his biggest threat towards him getting that three-peat?
Yeah, you've got 4 or 5 players anyway. You get Hovland back here, which is good. He won a couple of years back. Rams over here for the first time. although this is his debut. He's never been around this place, which is a bit of a surprise. And then you've got to look at, again, some of the English boys like Hatton and Fleetwood. Fleetwood coming off the back of 4 wins out of 4 last week. Hatton was undefeated as well. They've got to bring an awful lot of confidence. And, of course, they've got the game to shine around this place.
The guys mentioned Victor Hovland, and it was an ouchy end to the year for Victor. He took to social media with this picture of a broken pinky toe after he slammed it into his bed frame during the middle of the night. Guessing he made a noise when that happened. He did manage to tee it up at the Century, though, a couple of weeks ago. He hobbled his way up and down hills to a finish tied 36th.
You know, Hovland split with coach Joe Mayo late last year as their second split in the last 12 months. This week, he was on the range and working with a new swing coach named T.J. Yeaton from Indiana.
I mean, I'm certified nuts, so there's got to be some tinkering going on, but that's this game. But I at least have a way better understanding and appreciation for what I used to do, even though there were certain aspects before that I didn't necessarily love about my swing. Like, it looked quirky or looked goofy, but now I at least have a better understanding biomechanically why those golf swings worked and why I'm struggling now. So I just know a lot better. So now that when I can see it on camera, track my numbers, whatever you want to measure, I know what's good and what's not good. And I'll kind of stay within the boundaries, if that makes sense.
You've picked the brains of a few coaches, it'd be fair to say. You've got one now alongside you in TJ Eaton. Now, we know you like to take responsibility for your golf swing, though. Yep. What's his role within your team?
I have a lot of ideas, and I like to ask a lot of questions. And I do have a lot of knowledge now that I can kind of help myself in certain situations. And ultimately, I would want to have complete onus of my own golf swing. The thing is that it is nice to have another coach that knows it as well and can kind of bounce ideas back to me as well, so that I don't, you know, someone needs to check me along the way here, so that I don't just go, okay, 2 + 2 = 4, and then you're so far down the road. Like, you need to be deliberate in that process. So TJ does a good job with that.
In his press conference, Hovland was asked about some of the decisions he's made along the way.
Looking back, do you feel you've made some decisions that maybe you regret now?
I mean, you could say that. It wasn't, I think a lot of people have it maybe misconstrued a little bit that I made a conscious decision to go down this rabbit hole. I think it's just your golf swing is an ever-evolving organism, and every week you're out here playing, you have intentions and feels that would seem relatively innocuous, but you keep those intentions and feels in there, and they might morph into something else. And I just didn't address it. I just put it simply, I added a lot of draw pieces in my golf swing because I'd always been a cutter, and I wanted to see the ball, you know, not cut as much. And then you add more draw pieces in there, and then suddenly I get sick and tired of it missing left, and now I want to cut it. And that compensation was not good for my swing. So it's just a process of, you know, it happens. Like, you're not, I didn't go down there and said, no, this is better, I got to do this, and made a poor decision. It's just, that's the game of golf for you. It's hard to play good golf for 20 years straight.
Has any great golfer ever been more relatable than Victor Hovland, where he is right now?
I appreciate the honesty. You know, Martin Kammer wanted to hit draws. Also, wanted to hit draws for Augusta National, and he kind of lost his cut as well. It's a tale as old as time. I mean, I remember a story about Justin Rose not liking how his driver swing looked on the 72nd hole when he won the U.S. Open at Marion. And you heard Victor saying, there's something that I didn't like the way my swing looked.
Remember when Tiger said he didn't like the look of the way the ball was falling into the hole?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, they all have there are quirks here. I mean, Victor joined us on our set live from the U.S. Open.
Yes.
At Pinehurst. And we had a fascinating conversation because he had a different coach with him at that point as well. And he did talk about wanting to own his swing. And yes, he opens a lot of doors. But Victor's point was he closes a lot of doors behind him when he moves on to the next one, which is easier said than done. And when you look at Victor's numbers from, say, 2023, when he won the FedEx Cup, and compare them with 2024, there's not an enormous drop-off there. I mean, the putter is pretty much the similar. The irons are similar. Strokes gained off the tee is similar. Where there is a drop-off is the short game, which he'd focused on a lot when he was with Joe Mayo. And if you back in 2022, before he really got to work on that, he was 191st in strokes gained around the green. There weren't many worse on tour than Victor. He got to 100 in that category. Not great, but good enough to win a FedEx Cup and more than $30 million that year. He was back to 181st in that category last year. So he does seem to be heading into the rabbit hole. The question is, does he have the discipline that he thinks he has in terms of eliminating what is no longer useful?
Yeah. Is he dropping acorns or is he dropping like birdseed? Will he be able to find his way back to his old golf swing as he wants to? I mean, this is someone who does contend in major championships. He has four top tens in majors. He's won a U.S. amateur, been low amateur in majors twice. I just wonder, you know, you start shutting those doors and you start changing your DNA. Can you get back? He's called it. He's trying to get back to the old DNA. Like, where is my old golf swing now that I've gotten all this information, learned how things work? You know, you learn how the engine of the car works, but that doesn't mean, you know, it's better if you start taking it apart and putting it back together.
And golf swings are almost always sort of additive in terms of a career. It's very difficult to say, okay, well, you've put, over the course of a decade, you've put, you know, a half dozen coats of paint on a room, but if you start scraping it, that you'd get back to the perfect coat of paint that you had when you started with. It's never that simple.
Yeah.
And we've heard people say to, you know, Rory McIlroy should go back to swinging the way he used to swing 10 years ago. And we've seen, you know, Tiger, why don't you swing it this way? Everyone has different complications. They're either physical or it's mental scar tissue where they're trying to guard against a certain miss, or they're just, like Victor here, endlessly curious, but potentially damagingly curious. But I don't think he's in the damagingly curious point yet, as long as he does have discipline and ownership.
I walked away from that conversation, or he walked away from us, I should say, from that conversation in June at the U.S. Open, thinking this is just kind of how he is. He does have a curious mind. He does want to know how things work and why things happen, why he has certain ball shapes, why he has certain ball flights. I just think that's who he is. You know, some players don't want to know. You know, I've been told that there are kind of two kind of players that are successful on the PGA Tour. You're either really, really bright and you have that kind of mind, or you don't have any idea how things work. It's, if you're kind of somewhere in the middle, maybe you're never going to be ultimately great. Maybe he's going to find his way. Maybe he can be a tinkerer and be curious about swing weights and you know. But right now, he says sometimes he's, you know, across the top and getting steep on his swing, and he hasn't been able to find his way back to seeing that cut. You know, I want to hit a draw too. I can't hit a draw. You know, I'm nowhere near
it. You can't hit a cut.
I can't hit anything. I can't control it at all. But this is not the first time. I've been covering this game for a long time, and for Martin Kaymer, it was very similar. You know, he'd won majors and won the Players, and then, you know, he's trying to find a draw as well. He never really got back to being one of the best players in the world.
And where it's showing up with Victor now is in the results. He only made 17 starts last year and only three top tens. He was second at the FedEx St. Jude Championship. But other than that, his only notable performance was when he put himself in the mix at the PGA Championship, got away from him on that Sunday when he was going up against Bryson DeChambeau and Xander Schauffele. He ended up finishing third. That's a pretty pauperish return on the talent that Victor Hovland has and the potential he showed the year before.
And missed the cut in the other three major championships of 2024. We're getting closer to live golf at the top of the hour. Final round coverage of the Bahamas Golf Classic on the Korn Ferry Tour is coming your way.